Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, or Tuesday. It's not Monday anymore. It's Tuesday, the 26th of May. Hope you had a meaningful Memorial Day weekend. Craig Gilbert is our guest this hour of the program, covers Washington for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, also writes a blog about elections, public opinion, and political trends, and that is titled The Wisconsin Voter. He wrote over the weekend about Russ Feingold, whose poll numbers are very good this early in the game, and he asked, can Feingold come back from defeat? Can he recover his maverick brand? Can he reconstruct the appeal he once had to voters outside his Democratic base? We'll be talking about that this hour of the program. We'll look at Governor Scott Walker. Craig has covered the governor on the campaign trail, and we will discuss why he still appears to be the number one choice of those caucus voters in Iowa. We'll be looking at perks for million-dollar votes. We'll be looking at his poll numbers in the state of Wisconsin, which have been dropping. He is half the way to his goal of 250,000 jobs in his first term, so that is not going to happen. We'll look at his position on various issues. And also with this alarming news about ISIS gaining more and more territory, there have been a lot of reports on Republicans who are talking about ISIS, and they have a variety of ideas as to whether or not to deploy troops, how many troops should be deployed. We'll be looking at that issue and how important it will be in the presidential run. Welcoming phone calls, as always, and here is how you reach our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Craig. Nice to talk to you again.
Nice to be with you.
This article was really interesting. Feingold's an interesting politician, isn't he? His popularity ratings from the last Marquette poll, better, you say, than almost any politician Marquette has asked about in its 3.5 years of statewide polling. Why?
Well, and I should explain that. He doesn't have the highest, you know, positive rating of any candidate, but when you take his positives and his negatives together and you look at the percentage of people that view him favorably and the percentage of people that view him unfavorably, there's a pretty big gap between those two numbers. A lot of other politicians that, you know, you can poll about in the state of Wisconsin, like Governor Walker, President Obama, you know, they're very divisive, they're very polarizing. You know, you've got half the people like him and half the people don't like him. You've got our U.S. senators in Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson who are not 100% well-known, but people, the opinion about them among people who have heard of them and know something about them is pretty evenly divided. But here comes Russ Feingold, who's been out of politics, obviously, for several years, and his, you know, he's got a pretty good favorable rating, but he also has pretty low negatives. And he even has, you know, kind of surprising numbers from Republican voters. I mean, in this last Marquette poll, his the percentage of Republican voters that viewed him favorably was more than a quarter, which is a pretty remarkable number in the day and age in which we live in the state, that we're talking about, Wisconsin, where people are so polarized that nobody, almost nobody gets any support from voters in the other party. So his numbers in that sense are good, and I think they reflect in part his absence from politics, because he's not being defined right now. He's not in the public eye as a sort of partisan figure. But I think they also reflect the fact that even when he was going down to defeat in 2010, his numbers, his image was never that negative. I mean, he was obviously caught up in a political wave, and there were votes he took that people had that people were reacting negatively to. But it wasn't like he had sort of lapsed into this sort of deep unpopularity that we've seen with some other incumbents who lose their office.
Mm-hmm. Why did he lose in 2010?
Well, I think first and foremost, it was the nature of the year. It was a midterm, so we know that midterm elections have been harder for Democrats than presidential elections because the electorate is smaller, it's a little less diverse, it's older. It tends to be a little more conservative. And 2010 was the worst, you know, it was the best Republican year in Wisconsin since the 1930s, by depending on how you measure it. So it was a terrible year for a Democrat to be running statewide. And if you look at the two big statewide races, the one for governor and the one for senator, they were almost identical. I mean, they were basically 6 or 7 point victories for 5 to 7 point victories for Scott Walker and Ron Johnson. Not that much difference between them. So it was first and foremost a terrible year for Democratic candidates. And Russ Feingold had voted for the new health care law. He had voted for the stimulus. These were high-profile votes that were very unpopular with conservative voters, with Republican voters, and the conservative-leaning independents that turned out that year. There were other Democratic incumbents that did not lose, but I think it was the combination of the year and the nature of the election in Wisconsin, and also his opponent. I mean, he was running against somebody who he was kind of a nightmare opponent in a lot of ways. He was somebody that didn't have a political record, so he didn't have the baggage that comes with having a political record. So he was kind of new, and talking about Ron Johnson, he was new to politics, so he was a fresh face. And he had this business background, which kind of fit with the spirit of the time. So I think a lot of things came together to make that an election that, was very difficult for Russ Feingold to win. Some Democrats think he made mistakes and didn't run a very good campaign. But in the end, it's another question as to whether any of those mistakes actually cost him the election.
You cite Brad Todd, Ron Johnson's strategist, who says in your piece over the weekend, it has been since the 1930s that a senator last came back to beat the person that took him out of office. You can't escape the fact that Russ was fired despite the fact that he had a positive image among Wisconsin voters.
Well, it is a very unusual situation to have a Senate rematch, and it has been a long time since somebody succeeded under those circumstances, and it's just for obvious reasons. I mean, when people come back from elections, but when you're an incumbent who's lost their seat, especially after serving for multiple terms, I mean, that's kind of a form of political rejection, and it's hard to come back from that. I mean, most incumbents don't even try, but, it's hard to come back from that and succeed. And then when you're running against the same person who defeated you in the last election cycle, you're asking voters to basically for a do-over. I mean, you're asking voters to have the same choices in front of them and to make a different decision. You're asking some voters to change their votes. I mean, you're also depending, in Russ Feingold's case, on a different electorate, which is, I think, his chief hope, which is not so much that a whole lot of people are going to change their minds, but that there are going to be a lot of people voting in the presidential election in 2016 who didn't vote who don't vote in midterms and didn't vote in the 2010 midterm, and he's banking on the fact that electorate on the whole will be a better one for a Democrat like him than the 2010 electorate.
Uh-huh. You mentioned that Republican voters view him favorably by 25%. Does he need any of those voters to win?
Not necessarily. I mean, he's got a 27% favorable rating among Republicans. In the Marquette poll last month, 12% of Republicans said they would vote for Feingold if the election were held today. That was a bigger crossover than Ron Johnson was getting from Democrats. I think only 3% of Democrats said they would vote for Ron Johnson if the election were held today. So if Russ Feingold, to whatever extent Russ Feingold can get more Republicans voting for him than Ron Johnson can get Democrats voting for him, I mean, that's in his favor. It's just that the pattern we've seen in recent election cycles is that the percentage of people who cross over and vote for the candidate in the other party has just dwindled to, about 5%. So it's going to be very hard for Russ Feingold to hang on to low double digits when it comes to the Republican vote, but he doesn't need to in a presidential election, there's probably going to be more Democratic voters than Republican voters to begin with. So if they each hold their own with their own party, that's a slight advantage for Russ Feingold. And then it comes down to independents. The category we think of as independents, typically includes a lot of leaning Democrats and leaning Republicans. But overall, independents, voted against Russ Feingold in 2010. He has to hope that they vote for him this time around. He's doing really well with independents in the recent polling in Wisconsin. He had like almost a 20-point lead over Johnson with independents in Marquette's April poll. I mean, that's not necessarily sustainable, but mm-hmm. if he can just hold his own among independents and the electorate tilts a little bit Democratic, that's a winning formula.
And why is it, Craig, that the presidential electorate does include more Democrats than Republicans?
It's mainly because there are Democratic voting groups, demographic groups that tend to tilt Democratic, like young people and poorer voters, more transient voters, non-white voters tend to have, not always, but tend to have lower turnout rates in midterms, and the sort of the fall off from a presidential to a midterm is steeper. So that means that if you look at the electorate in a midterm, it might be in a state like Wisconsin, it might be 90% white in a midterm, and it might be 86 or 87% white in a presidential election. You know, voters under 30 might be 21 or 22% of the electorate in a presidential election, and they might be 17% of the electorate or 16% of the electorate in a midterm. So if you go up and down the line, those patterns tend to make for a better electorate for Democrats in a presidential and a better electorate for Republicans in a midterm. It doesn't dictate the outcome, because we've seen midterms where Democrats have done well, and we've seen presidential cycles where Republicans in Wisconsin have been very competitive. It's just structurally, it's all things being equal, it makes it easier for someone like Russ Feingold to win in a presidential cycle, and that's been the history in Wisconsin, where it's really been since 1980 that Republicans in Wisconsin have won a U.S. Senate seat in a presidential year.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the breakdown of the youth vote. I've just read that it was very, very strong in Ireland for the same-sex marriage vote, which was an incredible vote over the weekend, 62%.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine what would happen if young people voted in huge numbers in America. I wonder what would happen.
Well, and they certainly did vote in bigger numbers in 2008. And they tend to vote in bigger numbers in presidential races compared to midterms. Wisconsin's been a state where they've been a significant part of the electorate, particularly in presidential races. These numbers aren't perfect, but if you look at the exit polls, you know, they're in recent presidential cycles, the portion of the electorate in Wisconsin that's under 30 has been as big as almost any state in the country. Mm-hmm. So that's clearly sort of something that Democrats rely on and do their best to kind of mobilize that vote. And so it's one of the factors in all these elections, is one of many factors that can tilt the outcome.
I have to believe that somebody, and maybe you have inside information on this, approached Russ Feingold about running for governor in the state of Wisconsin. Do you know if he ever entertained that possibility?
Well, he was asked about it, and I think he was approached, and I don't think he got very close to wanting to run. And I think there was a point in time in which he made it clear and kind of indicated that he wasn't interested, for example, in being Scott Walker's recall opponent. I don't know how much of it was a judgment about the viability of doing it and whether he could win or not, and how much of it was maybe just some second, you know, some reservations about trying to do this in a recall and about the recall process. But I don't think he ever got all that close to wanting to run against Scott Walker in a recall. I don't know how interested he is in being governor. I mean, he was in the Senate for a long time. And when you look at what he did when he left the Senate, aside from teach law as a visiting professor, he was a diplomat.
Right.
And that was, you know, and foreign policy was a big part of his Senate portfolio. He was a diplomat in Africa. He was the chairman of the Africa Subcommittee, the Foreign Relations Committee. So he's, in a lot of ways, the Senate, I think, is just much more of a fit for him.
Craig Gilbert is our guest this Monday for All Things Political, and we'll welcome your phone calls. We'll move on to Governor Scott Walker. We mentioned the Marquette poll showing the very strong favorability ratings for Russ Feingold. Those numbers are falling for Governor Scott Walker. We'll ask Craig about that. We'll look at Iowa. He says it offers promise and peril for Governor Walker, who has outpaced the party's presidential field in most of Iowa polling this year. We will also look at the WEED Act controversy, with a couple Democrats asking for the Attorney General to investigate that. Are there problems at home, or do problems at home not necessarily translate to problems on the campaign trail if you're running for president? We will discuss that. We'll look at ISIS, the growth of ISIS, and what Republican candidates are saying about how they would counter that threat, and whatever else you would like to discuss. Here's our phone number, 800 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. How would you assess Russ Feingold in terms of favorability ratings? Do you have a favorable opinion of him? What about Ron Johnson? Do you think that those early polls showing that Russ Feingold is doing very well when it comes to popularity will translate to success at the polls, or is once you have beat a longtime incumbent senator that the chance that you could win against the person who defeated you, do you think that it's difficult? It's a hard thing to do. We'll be with you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Craig Gilbert is here now. He covers Washington for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and also writes about elections, public opinion, and political trends in the Wisconsin voter. Let's go to Jim in Rice Lake, our first caller for you, Craig. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, I'm a quick question. I mean, the fact that Walker is still under, you know, pending John Doe criminal investigation aside, what about, I mean, is nationally, will this, you know, Wisconsin Development Corporation disaster / scandal plus his failure to meet his job promises, will that potentially have an impact, not just in the Republican primaries, but in any presidential candidacy? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, sure. I mean, everything about, you know, it's tricky to run for president when you're a sitting governor, because everything about your record as governor obviously can impact you as a national candidate. So that goes for his jobs record. It goes for, you know, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, for better, for worse, everything you've done. And in fact, you know, on the better side, I mean, what's fueling his candidacy and the reason, you know, he gets such a welcoming reception among Republican voters around the country is, you know, this election record in Wisconsin combined with having a very conservative agenda and getting it implemented and getting reelected. And so that's the rationale for his candidacy. On the flip side, there were things, you know, about that record that could complicate his message either in a primary or in a general election, depending on what we're talking about. So, you know, we followed the saga of different statements he's made about immigration. His rhetorical record on immigration as governor of Wisconsin, which is not something he's really had to do with in a hardcore policy way, you know, has been a distraction at times. He's had to put out these little fires because I think it was perceived by some conservative Republican voters as him not being conservative enough or restrictionist enough on immigration. When you talk about a general election, you know, and even in a primary, as he's making the case about his economic record in Wisconsin, you know, we may see opponents, even Republican primary opponents, bring up his failure to deliver on his jobs promise and the record of private sector job creation in Wisconsin as it compares to other states. We may see his Republican rivals bring that up, and we can certainly see it brought up in a general election. So if he were to be the nominee. So, yes, everything about his record, not just as governor, but even before that as county executive, is going to be out there on the table for people to pick apart.
Is he still number one in Iowa, Craig?
I think so. I mean, Iowa in many respects is kind of tailor-made for him. It's the state next door. It's a state that he actually lived in for a few years as a boy. There's a big evangelical vote, and he's an evangelical Christian. It's a pretty, very conservative electorate. There are certain potential rivals of his, like Jeb Bush, that don't seem to be going anywhere in Iowa. So he's been the closest thing to a front runner in Iowa. I mean, he's been doing well in all the Iowa polling. So Iowa is not necessarily the kingmaker. I mean, it hasn't had a great record of delivering the winner of the Iowa caucus to the Republican nomination in recent cycles. But he does, I think, at this point have to do well in Iowa because of his early performance there, because of the expectation that Iowa is a good state for him. So I think it's important for him to do well in Iowa. I think he's arguably the Iowa front runner. That doesn't make him the front runner for the nomination, though.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and let's look at some of the other candidates here, lots of moderates, you write, think Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee are too conservative. Conservatives think that Bush is too moderate. 62% think that Walker is about right. Only Rubio showed such broad acceptability. Let's talk about Rubio some. Do you think he's gaining?
Yeah, I think he got a big bump out of his announcement. I think, again, we're in a funny phase of this process that people refer to as the invisible primary, where we don't really have great, other than the polling, we don't have great, it's probably our only way to really measure with numbers, other than fundraising, how these candidates are doing. The fundraising reports haven't come out yet. The polling has to be taken with a lot of caution, particularly the national polling, because that's not how the race is won or conducted. And when we start going into primaries and caucuses, because it's a sequential process, every contest can be dramatically affected by the contest that comes before it. So there's the caution with the national polling. But I think, part of the process in the invisible primary is, how are you doing with party elites? What do people on the Republican National Committee think of you? What do party officials in the early primary states think of you? What are the activists who are actually going to these events and following the process think of you? And by those, as far as we can tell, he's doing pretty well on all those measures. And I think one reason is, obviously, a lot of people would like to support a governor as opposed to a senator, for reasons we can talk about. He's the governor of a state that people think of as being a good state for Democrats, even though it's a swing state. Democrats have been winning it at the presidential level. So all that, and then his fight against the unions, all this stuff communicates to Republican primary voters, hey, the guy is conservative, and he's a fighter, and he won. And that's the, he's distilled that message now on the campaign trail, where he says, some of these guys are fighters, but they haven't really won anything. And some of these guys are winners, but they haven't really fought for anything hard, and I'm a fighter and a winner. That's kind of his sales pitch in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. So what are the perks for million-dollar voters?
Well, million-dollar donors, that came from a handout at an event that Governor Walker attended in Washington that was sponsored by the super PAC that's supporting him. This is the super PAC that was founded by, former strategists of his. And they're raising money to independently support Scott Walker, and under the rules as they're being interpreted and as they've been fashioned by legislation, but more importantly, court rulings, these groups can take unlimited contributions. And whereas the candidate, has a limit where he can only take a contribution of up to $2,700 in a primary, they can take million-dollar contributions. And so this group was offering potential donors a kind of a menu of choices, where if you give $250,000, it gets you, so many briefings a month and so many dinners with VIPs, unspecified VIPs, and you can go to a retreat, and you can, you get a staff person at the PAC that will that is individualized to you, and so on and so on. And so, if you're a $1 million giver, you get more of this great stuff than if you're a $500,000 giver, and if you're a $250,000 giver. So it was kind of an interesting document, because it's very starkly laid out in black and white.
Right.
It's also interesting because when you look at what you're actually getting, it doesn't seem like very much for your $1 million, but what you're really getting for your $1 million, obviously, is you're getting, the candidate knows you've given $1 million on their behalf, and that's what you're really getting.
Well, I looked at it and thought, why couldn't you throw in free dessert every day? Something fun, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Our phone number for Craig Gilbert is 800-486-8655. Sue sends this email: Craig, won't the new rules making it harder to vote hurt Feingold?
Well, I think she's referring to changes in the election law. We're going to have photo ID, which means voters will have to present a photo identification. We've seen the period of time for early voting cut down. These are some of the changes. There's other changes. Those are some of the most significant ones. We don't know. I think on balance, it appears that these new rules favor Republicans. If they favored Democrats, you wouldn't have seen a Republican legislature adopting the rules. But we don't know exactly what their impact will be. And usually an election has to be very close for these things to come into play and to matter, because they tend to affect things on the margins. The other thing you got to remember is, if the Democrats are worried about you know, the curtailing in the window, the early voting window, and the fact that you can't vote early on weekends any longer, well, then they're going to organize their strategy around that, and they're going to do things that they might not have done 4 years ago in order to try to maximize the early vote by their supporters. Republicans will do things too. So they're going to work really hard to try to make sure that all their supporters have photo IDs, particularly students. You've already seen, you know, some changes in, I think we're seeing changes in university IDs for that reason. So it's really hard to know. I mean, it's certainly you can make the case that in a super, super close election, these are things, and we've had some super, super close elections in Wisconsin, like the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections, which were decided by less than half a percentage point, 5,000-odd votes in one case and 11,000-odd votes in the other case. So it's possible. The chances are, you know, chances are against an election so close that things, something like this could make the difference. And there's obviously other factors that are going to be more important in the end, which go to, you know, what kind of an election cycle is it going to be, and what's the election climate going to be, what's the economy going to be doing, and all that.
And from Greg, he's confused about Walker's budget proposal. For example, zero state dollars to state parks, and yet $55 million for Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation.
Well, we have other reporters in our paper that are following the budget and writing about it, following it more closely than I am. So I would defer to them on some of the particulars. And also, it's not a done deal, obviously. They're still hashing out the budget. But, you know, we talked about what it means to run for president when you're a sitting governor, and one of the things that can come into play is a budget. The fact that, you know, you've alluded to Governor Walker's declining poll numbers in Wisconsin, again, looking at the same Marquette poll that we talked about earlier, and not just the Marquette poll, but also the poll that Wisconsin Public Radio sponsors with St. Norbert Survey Center and some other polls that have been done by other organizations have all shown, you know, some of the same trends. Feingold doing well. They've shown Governor Walker down in his numbers and in negative territory, with more people disapproving than approving of the job he's doing. And so why is that? And, you know, there's a couple of potential explanations. One is, you know, he's been out of the state, so he's not around. Because he's running for president, he's not around to defend himself and advocate for himself the way he would be normally. Maybe some people think the fact that he's running for president is a negative, and he's not on the job 100% of the time. And another potential explanation is the budget, which has been controversial. There's a lot of things in there that are not polling particularly well. And so Governor Walker has suggested that once the budget is done, that will kind of fade and his numbers will bounce back. So it'll be interesting to wait and see whether that happens. But the budget is something that needs to be done, he has said, before he can announce for president. And it's why we may not see his announcement until July.
Let's go to Joe in Westfield. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Hey, Craig, Joe, Washington Seminar Program. Thanks for seeing our kids every year.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Anyway, just, you know, those of us that liked Feingold really enjoyed that campaign finance reform law of 2002. And my question is campaign finance reform dead as an issue in Congress and national politics now, or do you think if Feingold is elected, perhaps he would work to resurrect that in the post-Citizens United world we live in today?
Well, I mean, he might go to work on that. It's just the prospects are really poor at this point for a variety of reasons. One, that the issue is more polarizing along party lines than it was when McCain-Feingold was passed. McCain-Feingold, you know, it's sort of, you look back at McCain-Feingold, it's extraordinary that it ever did get passed. You obviously had a Republican author in John McCain and a Democratic author in Russ Feingold, but it still had to get passed by the Senate. And it also, which requires 60 votes to do anything in a very evenly divided Senate, it did have a lot of Republican votes in the end, and then it had to be signed by a Republican president, George W. Bush. So it's kind of amazing in retrospect that ever happened. You know, Republicans, I think, you're less likely to see any Republican support for something like that. Also, the Supreme Court, as it was constituted when it first considered the lawsuit against McCain-Feingold, basically sustained McCain-Feingold, upheld the key pillars of McCain-Feingold. And then the court changed with the departure of Sandra Day O'Connor, and you have a more conservative court now on this issue. And they have been, the court has been kind of really issuing rulings that call into question the constitutionality of a lot of campaign regulation and restrictions. And so you couldn't even legislate if you wanted to some of these things because of the way the Supreme Court is ruling and has ruled. So the only way I think it comes back is if, you know, as we kind of, as this environment plays out, which some people sort of liken to the Wild Wild West, it's a very unfettered, open-ended campaign finance landscape where the limits on contributions to candidates aren't so meaningful when super PACs can take million-dollar contributions and play the same role or a very similar role in a campaign. Now, so the only scenario under which I think we're going to see this issue raised again on the part of successfully on the part of so-called campaign finance reformers is if there's a backlash, a political backlash against this new wide-open system we have now. I'm not predicting that's going to happen, but I'm saying it would probably take something like that to see sort of serious campaign regulation come back. Right now, it's even, you know, even just getting disclosure rules passed is proving very difficult in Congress.
Hmm. Thank you, Joe, for your call. Connie in Mequon. Hi, Connie.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a question. There's so much talk about the voter ID and how it's going to make so many people not be able
to... Oops. I'm sorry, Connie. Call back, please. I'm very sorry. A button flew off my machine here, and I tried to put it back on, and it disconnected you. So please call back, Connie. And if you'd like to join our conversation, Connie was going to ask something about voter ID, so we'll get it. Call us back. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. When does the Supreme Court issue rulings on same-sex marriage and on the Affordable Care Act, Craig?
I think the Affordable Care Act ruling is expected certainly this summer. I'm not sure about the other one, but, you know, those are obviously pretty momentous,
yes,
potentially momentous rulings. The health care ruling could really be momentous politically if it led to, you know, if it led to, you know, kind of the dismantling or partial dismantling of the new healthcare law. I mean, the politics of that would be pretty interesting and a little unpredictable, I think.
Well, what would be the politics of that? I guess both sides could use it, or it would be to the Republicans' advantage, I would think.
Well, but those things can cut both ways. I mean, you know, it's sort of, you know, one truism about these rulings and about politics in general is that the if you take something away from somebody, those are the people that end up being most mobilized by that event. And so it's possible that just as the implementation of the healthcare law was kind of a political boost in some sense to Republicans because it helped fuel the Tea Party movement of 2010, help mobilize Republicans against the new healthcare law. It's possible that a ruling against the healthcare law, and also depending on how the Republican Congress followed through with that, it's possible that could mobilize Democrats who are angry about it. So that's why these things are hard to predict, because it's not just about, you can sort of predict how different people are going to react to it, but what you can't predict is the intensity and the motivation.
And Connie has been kind enough to call us back. I'm sorry, Connie. Hi.
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 I just, then that's fine. I just, all this voter ID talk, and you have to have an ID to do just about everything. I guess I don't always understand how there's so many, people feel there's so many voters that won't be able to vote because they need an ID.
Well, we don't know how many people there are. We know that where the controversy comes is because, depending on how these laws are drafted, you can quantify the number of people that don't have an ID that would meet the requirements in the law. Now, these laws end up going through changes too, and also people change in response to the laws, and that's why we don't know what that true number is actually going to be. But there are people, you know, if you just look at driver's licenses, I mean, there are people that don't have driver's licenses. And when this law was first announced, you know, they were, it looked like a lot of student IDs, college student IDs, weren't going to meet the requirements of the law. So it can take a lot of different effects. I mean, it's true that we don't know exactly. It's very hard to put a number on it. And even in states where that have passed these, where the laws have actually been implemented, there's been, you know, kind of disagreement about what the impacts have been. There have been some government studies of this which suggest that overall there is a net effect and that there's a potential drop in turnout that's steeper among more Democratic voters than more Republican voters. But it's kind of a muddy picture, and you know, we'll sort of see how it sorts out over time.
Thank you, Connie, very much for your call. Let's talk about ISIS for a moment and Republican response to what seems to me to be just this quagmire, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. ISIS claiming more and more territory. New York Times had a piece over the weekend. The GOP field skirts specifics on ISIS, so you go everywhere from Lindsey Graham and Rick Santorum wanting to deploy 10,000 American troops as part of a coalition with the Arab nations, and then you have Rand Paul saying he wants boots on the ground, but only Arab boots on the ground. Others are calling for more airstrikes. We've had, I guess, over 4,000 airstrikes, and this organization just keeps getting more and more territory. Is this going to be, are we tuned into this? Do we know what we want as Americans on this issue? Do the Republicans find this an issue to campaign on or to shy away from, Craig?
I think it's both. I mean, it's, you know, we're still living in the shadow of the Iraq War and the mistakes that were made in going to war. And so that casts a long shadow over not just the mistakes in terms of the rationale for going to war and the fact that there weren't not weapons of mass destruction, which was offered as the chief rationale for going to war, but also obviously the conduct of the war and the post-war failures that occurred. So that, you know, has made troops on the ground in the Middle East, you know, something that people are thinking two or three or four times about before wanting to commit to. At the same time, Republicans will be making the argument that this is President Obama's great foreign policy failing, that he's a weak foreign policy president, and that he's allowed this sort of vacuum to grow in which ISIS and other groups have flourished. So it's a double-edged sword, I think, for both parties, and that's why, even though it's almost universal among the Republican candidates, these broader arguments about we have to do more and be more aggressive, and President Obama's not doing enough, it's a lot less clear what the differences are when it comes to military intervention. And there are differences. I mean, you know, obviously Rand Paul is the great dissenter on a lot of these issues within the Republican field because he's very explicitly warning against military intervention and making the argument that we should only intervene when the conditions meet a pretty narrowly defined notion of what's in our national interest. So there is a debate, but I would say the general consensus among the Republican presidential candidates tends to be more hawkish, certainly more hawkish than Rand Paul, but they are wary of what they say about, you know, you tend to hear formulations like we shouldn't rule anything out, which is different from saying this is what we ought to do with our military.
It strikes me that nobody knows exactly what to do.
Well, with good reason. I mean, if you look at Iraq, it's there's so many moving parts, and it's you know, every action spawns a reaction, and given how fragmented that country is, and given the nature of the government there, and given the ways in which everything we've done, you know, is kind of cast a shadow forward, and everything we might do, it's a pretty hard problem.
Craig Gilbert is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about a variety of issues. Craig covers Washington for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he also writes The Wisconsin Voter. It's a blog about elections, public opinion, and political trends. So lately he's been concentrating on Feingold's entry into the Senate race and a repeat of the Johnson Feingold race 6 years ago. We're also talking about Scott Walker on the campaign trail and problems in the state for the governor, poll numbers dropping and what that means. Also, what's been going on with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And we're talking about Republicans' strategy when it comes to dealing with ISIS. We should talk about the Democrats' strategy as well. Bernie Sanders is officially entering the presidential race today. Does that make any difference in terms of the issues that he brings up, which are of concern to most Americans, and he has appeal to a certain number of Americans? Will what he has to say influence the Democrats in any way? Few of the issues that we are discussing this hour. And feel free to join the conversation. Again, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Craig Gilbert is here now, 800-486-8655. Pat is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope I don't get too convoluted here, but if you want to talk a little bit more about ISIS, when we did go into Iraq and my friends and in general my family was against it, we saw it as, you know, not necessary. The stories of the families and wedding parties getting blown up and, you know, indiscriminate civilians getting killed. It really, I remember saying back then, you know, 5-6 years ago, these people, they're going to hate us forever. And so now we have these young men that are, that maybe saw their family get blown up at a wedding, you know, or just, you know, having dinner. They're saying, hey, we don't like the Western politics. And they do seem to be just, you know, they witnessed the destruction of their towns by supposedly this, our great country, and I think we have to be this great country of being brave and not wielding the big stick. So I think it's important that the politics coming ahead for our next president is who is going to be the brave leader and not continue to bomb.
Craig.
So you're hearing, you know, two very different arguments being made about Iraq by Republicans and Democrats, and Democrats, by and large, are saying, you know, we're in this mess because we got into this war that we shouldn't have gotten into. And Republicans are saying we're in this mess because President Obama didn't, withdrew too soon and didn't follow through and didn't stay committed to the task. Politically, it's going to be interesting to see not only which of those messages, you know, resonates more with American people, but also, you know, whether how receptive American voters are to these kind of different approaches on foreign policy. Are people going to be more hawkish or less hawkish? And how much role is foreign policy, period, going to play in this election? It certainly looks like it's going to be playing a role in the Republican primaries. Maybe not the role, but certainly a major role. It's a bar that every candidate has to kind of, a threshold every candidate has to meet on some level. And how much of it is going to play in the general election? I mean, you know, how much in the presidential and how much in a Senate race like the Feingold-Johnson race, where you have these rich foreign policy contrasts because of the way Senator Johnson has kind of taken on a higher profile in foreign policy and national security issues, but in a very different way than Senator Feingold did. So there's a potential even in some of these Senate races for foreign policy to play an important role.
So has everybody satisfactorily, to the point where we can move on, answered the question, should we have gone into Iraq?
Well, there's some nuances there that haven't really been answered. I mean, you know, people have spoken to whether they would or wouldn't have gone in, whether they would have gone in if they'd known, if the intelligence was definitive in their mind about lack of weapons of mass destruction. I think we need to hear more from the candidates about what they think the lessons were of Iraq. And people are also kind of offering different versions of history of how that decision was made, and whether the intelligence was, whether it was simply about the intelligence or whether the intelligence was misread or willfully misread. Those are all arguments that Democrats and Republicans are having, and Republicans in some cases with each other.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bernie Sanders officially saying that he's running for president today. What does he add to the race? Is he covering issues that a lot of Democrats want to hear about? If so, what are they? Or is he just a superfluous person to have around?
Well, I think, you know, he can have an impact just by being, you know, another Democratic candidate in the race when you've got the Hillary Clinton, you know, the front runner Hillary Clinton, and her seemingly inexorable march to the Democratic nomination.
Yes.
I think it can change the dynamic a little bit to have a alternative candidate. You know, it'll tell us something about whether anybody out there who is an alternative to Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side gets anything going, gets any traction. You know, do they get 20% of the vote, 30% of the vote, 40% of the vote, 50% of the vote in a given state? That'll tell us something, and it could have an impact on Hillary Clinton in terms of making her a stronger or weaker candidate.
Let's go to Tom in Cable. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Your guest expert said something about the withdrawal, the end of the war in Iraq, and kind of repeated the Republican talking points that Obama, you know, maybe did the wrong thing, took troops out. What Obama did was follow the negotiated policy that President Bush had negotiated with Maliki. It was exactly what Bush had negotiated. No different. And so we did withdraw. And if you remember, you know, reading papers, looking at news, just before the election, long before Obama was ever elected, Ahmadinejad went to Baghdad a couple of times and literally got a red carpet welcome, where our own presidents had to fly in under cover of darkness and could only be there for 3 hours. The die was cast. We knew what was going to happen. It was a failure before it started. And, you know, the failure has just mounted in the years following.
So what do you think we should do, Tom?
Well, I think what we should do is allow the people there to sort it out, and they're going to. I don't feel any great threat from ISIS. I mean, we've got enough strategic nuclear weapons to destroy the world 1,600 times over. I'm just not that worried about what's going on in a few of those countries in the Middle East. I'm really not, and I don't think we need to be.
Craig.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, I was repeating the Republican talking point as the Republican talking point, because that's, you know, that's the debate, part one dimension of the debate that you're going to be hearing going forward on this issue from both parties. You'll be hearing Republicans arguing that President Obama didn't stay the course and hasn't been vigorous enough and firm enough and strong enough on foreign policy, and so that is going to be a big part of the foreign policy debate, politically speaking, in this race.
And thank you very much for the call. So what's up this week? Well, it's a short week, right, in D.C., Craig?
But we're going to find out how Republicans are going to try to move forward with the Patriot Act, which was left hanging before they went off on recess. Jim Sensenbrenner has a bill that passed the House overwhelmingly that would end the bulk collection of metadata of call records. It only got 57 votes in the Senate, which is a majority, but it wasn't the 60 you needed to proceed beyond a filibuster. So the Republicans have to sort that out. That's kind of a big thing that'll happen. I'll actually be following Scott Walker up to New Hampshire this weekend.
Oh, you will?
Yeah.
Oh, what's going on in New Hampshire? It's just one of those...
Just campaigning.
Hanging out. Trying to get some more of those votes. Everybody's doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks, Craig, so much.
Okay, thank you.
Craig Gilbert, our guest this hour for All Things Political, and he's here fairly regularly with us. He writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's the Washington Bureau Chief, and he also does this really interesting blog, The Wisconsin Voter. It's a blog about elections, public opinion, and political trends. We thank him for his expertise. Join us, please, for the next hour of our program, which should be interesting. It will be an intimate look at fatherhood with Paul Gale, a 19-year-old dad in Milwaukee who's single father for the most part, raising his baby daughter, having a really hard time finding a safe and decent place to live and also a job. So we will look at all of the issues that are associated with early parenthood and poverty, hour two of our program today, and welcome your phone calls. Thanks very much to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We'll be with you shortly after the news from National Public Radio to have another hour.